It is my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Scott T. from Utica, New York.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Scott Tranter, and I am an alcoholic. Oh, I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the people, and I got to start off and tell you it has not always been like that. It's a privilege and an honor to be here at the specific group. You know, I'd like to thank Bob for inviting me and the people that were involved in getting me here. It's been a couple of years since I've been here. You got a wonderful new facility. Last time I was here, I believe you were in the synagogue. And now you're at St. Anne, the home of the Crusaders. And, you know, I was thinking about that when I was looking at it. You probably had people up here giving talks talk about the home of the Crusaders. And I was thinking about the holiday time. And I used to go on a lot of crusades during the holiday time. And it's not like that, today. Tom, thanks for opening this up. Tom just flew in from Panama City Beach, Florida, got off the plane and came right over to the little dinner we were having and came over here. And he felt, I'll tell you, he felt uncomfortable being up here without a suit and tie, okay? And but it's okay because Bob said it was okay. So, you know, it's that's just a little inside joke. You know, Lori was going to try to lead the meeting and explain to everybody that I'm the only man alive that has ever slept with her husband with permission. Now there's a story behind that, and I'll get to that later, but we do have pictures. You know, Alan and I were talking just a little while ago about this past weekend we were just involved with up at State Line, and you guys have had one heck of a week here, opening up last week with Sandy Beach, then going through the State Line with all those wonderful people up there that were imparting some knowledge. You know, I love it in AA when people say there's no teachers. And, you know, to be a teacher is just someone simply that imparts the knowledge from one person to another. And that's what I saw a lot of this weekend. I see a lot of teachers in here, too, you know, and it's what we do with each other is we impart knowledge from one person to another with our experience, strength, and hope. And that's what we learn to do around here, you know. We learn to share our experience, strength, and hope and what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. I love it when people get up here and they say, well, I don't know what I'm going to say. And when they say that, I say, well, then sit down. You know, I mean, that's just my attitude because, see, one of the things about alcoholism is I thought I knew what alcoholism was and what I thought I knew what it wasn't dealing with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, I didn't have a clue. I didn't understand that I was in an absolute fight for my life, that alcoholism wanted to kill me. It wanted to rob from me anything that was ever good in my life and just tear it down. You know, Tom mentioned chapter 3 when it talks about the through every form of the experimentation, the self-deception, we try to prove ourselves exception to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. And I think that's what we do when we don't have an understanding or a clear knowledge of what we're dealing with, you know. I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 34 years ago, and I'm from back east. I'm from Boston. Anybody from Boston here? Yeah, we got a few from Boston. I grew up in the projects, a place called Germantown in South Boston. I used to, you know, one of the things about the book is it talks about in the 12 and 12 that defiance is one of our chief character traits, and I was very defiant as a young man. And if a teacher or babysitter or whoever tried to tell me what to do, I would always rebel against it. You know, I didn't know, according to our book, that the alcoholic is like the tornado roaring through the lives of others. It talks about the warped lives of blameless wives, children, stuff like that, and my dad was that alcoholic. I didn't understand any of it. I just knew that I didn't like them, you know. I know what it's like to stand in line and get those blocks of cheese and powdered milk and get hand-me-downs and the Salvation Army coming to pick me and my brothers up and take us out for a Christmas. I just knew I didn't like the man. I didn't like the police always at my house. You know, my friend Sean Mulkern says that the type of neighborhood we grew up in, it was the type that if you had a heart condition and you went out and you told your friends, they'd punch you in the chest just to see how bad your heart was, okay? So, yeah, you didn't learn to show feelings and emotions. You kept all that stuff inside because where I was raised, if you showed those feelings and emotions, you were weak. And if you were weak, people took advantage of you. That's just the bottom line. You know, I started going to a program called Al-Anon, and it actually was at St. Anne's Church and in North Quincy, in Quincy, Massachusetts. And my dad, do we got any Al-Anons here? few. My dad was the type that would follow my mom and I to the Al-Anon meeting, sit down the street drinking in his van, and then follow us home and beat my mom up and call her a whore, and who was she meeting there, because he knew that she was meeting somebody, you know, and she wasn't meeting anybody. She was just trying to find a better way for her boys and herself to learn about this disease of alcoholism. Make no mistake, it's a family disease, you know. It is absolutely a family disease. When it talks about the tornado and the warped lives of blameless wives and children, it affected us in ways that we didn't even have a clue, okay? Alcoholism. And that defiance, I went to Alateen. I used to take the trains into Southie and South Boston, and I didn't get anything out of Alateen because I didn't want anything out of Alateen. It was a place for me to go and manipulate and get you to feel sorry for Scotty and the way I was being raised, so I didn't get anything out of Alateen, you know? Around this time I had my first arrest. I was 12 years old. And the drinking age was 18 in Massachusetts, so I always, you know, hung around with older kids. And being from the neighborhood of being Irish and Catholic, you grew up, that's what you did, is you drank. And you could drink in the pubs and stuff, Kelly's Pub and the Irish Pub, you know, if you were 14 years old. And you could drink in those places. And the drinking age was 18. And so, you know, my story is not the story of drinking out of that brown paper bag at the age of five, but I drank whenever and how often I could. And my first arrest came, it was for assault and battery on a police officer and drunken disorderly conduct. And I got sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I walked into the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I talk a lot about customs, you know. You heard Tom get up here and identify and say a sobriety date, and that came from Texas. We have customs all over the country. That particular custom came from Texas, where people would get up and they would say their name and their sobriety date. And this guy, John, got up and said, "My name's John, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since January 18th, 1997. And, I mean, 1977. And this guy over across the room jumped up and said, "Wait a goddamn minute, John, I saw you drunk last week." He said, "I know, but it wasn't necessary," right? So it's all in how you look at it, right? These are customs. You know, I'm going in and out of these meetings, and you have a wonderful custom out here in Las Vegas, as they do in Southern California, where they read a portion of Chapter 5 from the Big Book on how it works, where they read a portion of Chapter 3, where they read a vision for you. These are all customs, okay? And that's part of the fellowship, that when you start a group or you have a meeting and you have an area, all over the country developed their own customs. And back in New England, they did not do any readings at all. This is the specific group, and let's say you had the double-digit meeting. The double-digit meeting would come in and lead your meeting, and you, as a specific group, wouldn't even be allowed to participate in it, okay? And this is how it worked back there, and the meeting would start, and the meeting would end with the Lord's Prayer, just like that. And I would come into these meetings, and I wasn't getting anything. I was going back out the door. You couldn't even share. You couldn't even talk unless you had 90 days. You know, and I was a 13-year-old kid, and I had a lot of good stuff to share, but I couldn't even get 90 days, you know, because I noticed a few people here tonight identified as addict alcoholic, okay, and that was, to me, that's like saying I'm from Los Angeles and California, you know. When I drank, I'm a garbage pail, and that opened the door for everything else for me. See, I show respect for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I show respect for the traditions and Tradition 3 and all those who suffer from alcoholism. See, people in NA, that have drug addiction, they can go to NA. You know, people that have cocaine addictions, they can go to CA. Alcoholics have one place to go, okay? We have here to go. It seems that people filter in from all other fellowships, and they come in here and they think it's okay to just try to take over our meetings and our fellowships. But I talk to the real alcoholic, and I'm not getting controversial here. Please don't take it that way, because I am a garbage pail and I did everything underneath the sun. But this is Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? And I show respect for the program that absolutely saved my life. I didn't know this at the time, though. I didn't know this because drugs were an outside issue, okay? And people would come into the meetings and they would get up and they would talk about drugs and they would get pulled from the podium, okay? That's an outside issue. So some of my role models in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of misconceptions on what AA is. And just to give you a couple for instances, you know, you hear things like read the book or get a sponsor, and how they did it back then in New England is, let's say Bob is my sponsor. And I was going to take a birthday medallion tonight. Okay, they didn't sing happy birthday. You get a medallion. Bob would get up here and tell all of you about me. And he would tell you everything I've done in the last year, my community involvement, the steps I've taken, and what I'm doing now. And then I would get up and say a few words and sit down. And I had already been in and out of some of the detoxes at 14, eating out of dumpsters and trash cans and Skid Row at 16. And I'm trying to find a better way in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never read the book. I had never gotten a sponsor. And this guy was getting, he was one of the youngest young people in the group. And he was like 30 years old, and he was taking a four-year medallion. His name was Fred, and I was sitting in the front row, and Fred's sponsor got up and said all this wonderful stuff about Fred. And I'll never forget it, because I'm listening to him, and the guy's young, and I'm thinking, wow, just maybe this, you know, this guy can be my sponsor. And then Fred got up, and he took his medallion, and he was looking at it, and he says, you know, I was really nervous this morning when I woke up, because I knew I was going to have to get up here in front of all you people. So I smoked a joint to take the edge off, okay? And he went on. And I got to tell you, I loved what Fred had to say. And when that meeting got over, I went right up to Fred and asked him to be my sponsor. So that was my first experience with sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Now, make no mistakes, years later, when I finally read the book, when I finally did the deal, Dr. Silkworth closes all those loopholes. When he talks about that we can't take alcohol in any form, okay, he's talking, any form means the marijuana, the cocaine, the heroin, the for me, you know, the Prozac or the Xanax and all this other stuff. It means that, you know what, I can't take alcohol in any form, okay? That I have a prescription here, which are called the 12 steps that are outlined in the big book, that if I do that, it's a process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding. I just might be able to live in my skin with a little simple dignity, okay? That's what it's about, okay? It's that common solution that you hear people get up here and talk about that they really don't know what they're talking about, because everybody says, oh, it's a common solution. We got a common solution. Well, the common solution is the spiritual experience, the spiritual awakening, if you please, that when we go through this process, okay, we get to maybe with a little simple dignity walk through life. Doesn't mean I don't have anger or resentments or fears or frustrations. I have goals and dreams and aspirations, but what it is, okay, is that this thing is outlined so that I can live inside my skin just a little bit. Now, do not get me wrong here. I am not saying if you're on psych meds to stop taking them. I am not telling you don't take them. I'm not a doctor. I'm not qualified to give that advice. Okay, that's why we have doctors and professionals. I would never do anything like that. My personal experience, as Tom said, it's not for people that want it or need it. It's for people that do it. Is my experience is when I was doing that, because along this time, and I'm getting into my middle ages here as a teenager, they're strapping me to beds. They're pumping me full of Thorazine, lithium, chloral hydrate, Haldol. They're running me through the mill because I'm homicidal, suicidal, manic depressive. And I got to tell you, I was misdiagnosed. That's what I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, okay? And when these common manifestations, when they're trying to fill these things inside me and they're giving me all these medications and stuff, my bottom line for me is that I was just lazy. See, I wasn't willing to do this deal. I wasn't willing to get the sponsor, to get the commitments, to go through the big book, okay? And that's my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. 90% of the people are just lazy, okay? And that's an opinion off experience that I have. And the reason why I'm saying this is because we were talking a little earlier, too. I believe that words have the power to heal, okay? But I also believe words have the power to kill. I really believe that, okay? Because I've seen it. I've been in alcoholics long enough and around long enough to see it happen, okay? So I'm very careful with words that I use in Alcoholics Anonymous and what I say and what I don't say, because I want you to see what Alcoholics Anonymous means to me and what it has done to me and for me by doing this deal. See, at the time, I didn't know any of these things. I didn't know that I was a taker. I didn't know that I was selfish and self-centered and self-seeking and self-pitying, driven by those 100 forms of fear and self-delusion. I didn't know that I was making decisions based on me, which kept placing me in the position to be hurt by you. I didn't know any of these things. And I didn't have the man that was properly armed with the facts about themselves, as our book says, to teach me this stuff. See, Bill Wilson, one of our founders, talked about that alcoholism is like a cave. And in that cave of alcoholism is the jails and the institutions and all these things. They called them asylums back then. But in that cave is Scotty, and I'm drowning in alcoholism. And see, when the psychiatrists or the priests or the moms, and they come to the mouth of the cave and they say, Scotty, come on out, they don't understand that I really want to come out. Scotty really wants to come out. I just don't know how. And see, none of them were properly armed with the facts to come in and get me. The magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, the magic of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, the man that's been properly armed with the facts about themselves, not about the disease of alcoholism and everything. See, make no mistake, I am not an expert on alcoholism. What I'm well versed at, though, is a 12-step program of recovery that helps gives us through that process that we can get properly armed with the facts and we can go into the cave. See, that's what happened to me eventually. If someone came into the cave and they took me by the hand, they said, come on, Scotty, this is what I did, this is what you do, this is how we get out of it. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that one alcoholic talking to another, okay? See, so don't make no mistake that I'm not this expert in alcoholism, because I'm not. I've just been well versed by doing the deal, following the steps, doing the prescription that's outlined in the book that has put me in a position where I became properly armed with the facts about me through the steps, okay? And I didn't know this at the time, and so consequently, the bottom line is it caused me a lot of heartache. I was in and out of jails, institutions, halfway houses, recovery homes, type to shave your head, made you wear dunce caps. Ended up getting a girl pregnant. That didn't work out. I got, those of you from Boston, I found myself in the combat zone. And a few buddies of mine, we were rolling prostitutes in the red light district. And I had been through all those scared straight programs of the 70s where you'd go into Walpole and Bill Ricka and all these state prisons, and the convicts would come up to you and, give me your shoes, this is what I'm going to do to you when I'm going to bend you over. And they'd tell you all this stuff that they're going to do to you, trying to scare you straight. And I was smuggling drugs into them. I became a mule. And it was a joke to me. It was just a joke, because I was always smarter than, other than, better than, but I wasn't a part of, you know, and it was all a game to me. And all of a sudden now I'm arrested and as an adult, and I'm in the Charles Street Jail, which is the oldest jail in New England, 5 tiers. I walked in there like that Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder movie, Stir Crazy, That's Right, We Bad. And I walked in and this guy got thrown off the 5th tier and he got killed, and it scared me to death. You know, and I had heard all the things that they do to cute little punks in these adult facilities, and I was cute, and I had long hair, and I was scared, okay? And I had made the decision. Big Book talks about the jumping off point. There will be those of us that choose to make the supreme sacrifice and to continue the fight, and it's talking about suicide. And I decided, you know what, I couldn't do this. I couldn't picture life with alcohol or without alcohol. I had tried all these different things, and I just decided I was going to check out and I was going to kill myself. And I ended up getting bailed out, and I went to my little apartment, and I filled up the bathtub, and I cut my wrists all the way down, 110 stitches in each arm, and I bled out, and that's how they found me. And I came to 5 days later on the critical list, and I had all those feelings that you hear people say, I couldn't even do that right, okay? I was so flawed and ashamed and defective and unlovable, and all these feelings that we get, I don't care if you're a man or you're a woman, they're basically they're human emotions, and that's what we deal with in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the basic human instincts of the security, the sex, and the social, and what I'm doing, and I'm looking for, I'm looking with, and I'm all caught up in me, and you know, I ended up beating that case, and I got put in Medfield State Hospital twice. And this woman came to see me, and she told me about this guy named Jesus Christ, that if I accepted him as my personal savior, that behold, everything would be new. And I was, you know, born and raised Irish and Catholic, and my God was a judging God and a condemning God, and I was being cast into the lake of fire. And, you know, she told me about this loving God, and I said, why not? And alcoholics like us, we go from one extreme to the next, and I quit smoking, swearing, watching TV, listening to rock and roll. I went into the ministry. I went into a place called Teen Challenge, and I started going to Bible studies 5 hours a day, church 7 days a week, giving my testimony how Christ had saved my life. And I'd come into halls, not this big, but halls like this, and in the born-again Christians would be talking in tongues and passing out. And, you know, I was that square peg just trying to fit in. You know, I just want to fit. They had something in the eyes, sort of like the old-timers have. They had something in the eyes that I wanted. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted to be a part of. And so I decided, well, I'm going to pass out like these guys. And so I'd get filled up with the Spirit, and I'd fall back, and I'd hurt my neck and my back. And these people weren't getting hurt, so I figured I'm not going to do that. And I'll start talking in tongues, and so I'd start making this stuff up, talking in tongues, and old Alan over here would start interpreting what the Spirit was telling him I was saying, so I know he's full of crap because he's a hypocrite because I'm making it up, right? So you got to follow me. Bob talks about the throne of judgment, but that's what it is, and I'm on this throne of judgment now because now he's a hypocrite, I'm making it up, you're all hypocrites, you're all full of crap, this whole thing's full of crap, and what I had done, the way the Big Book is outlined and written, is from the doctor's opinion to page 63, deal with a couple things and their conclusions of the mind. That I'm alcoholic, my life's unmanageable, unmanageability simply means not achieving one's purpose. You know, coming to believe, came to believe that this power His power greater than me could restore me to sanity. It's talking about the sanity of the first drink or the insanity of the first drink. It's not talking about the sanity of the world. They're conclusions of the mind, you know, making that decision, the third step, to turn my will and my life, my thoughts and my actions over to this care of God. I had done all this, okay? What I had never done, though, was a fearless and thorough moral inventory of myself. And that's what I was. I was full of crap, okay? All inside me, I was full of crap. I'm coming into these things, people trying to teach me good things. It's sort of like AA. People come in, they do 1, 2, 3, go out. 1, 2, 3, go out. 1, 2, 3, go out. You know, and that's what I was doing. And I had never done that fearless and thorough moral inventory of myself. It scared me, okay? But I just knew I was full of crap. And what it was like is a cup of coffee over there, you know? I was trying to dump it. I was trying to get it out. And I didn't realize that the way the steps were designed is it's like a cup of coffee that you could take over to the sink and drip cool, clear water into it. Come back an hour from now, it's still dark and dirty on the inside. You know, what the steps were designed to do is for me to dump that stuff so that maybe I could start keeping some of this good stuff, okay? And I was just full of crap. I was a vessel full of crap trying to fill good stuff in, and it wasn't taken because I had done a lot of bad things. You know, in AA you hear people say, we're not bad people, we're just sick people trying to get better. And that's okay for some people, but you know, I did a lot of bad things, okay? I was a blackout drinker. I would wake up in strange places with money and different things that I had done, wondering if I hurt anybody. I had done a lot of bad things. And you know, it was time that I started doing some good things. Chuck C. used to talk about writing a record. My friend Jim Buckley talks about the ledger, okay, and that it's time we start doing good, okay, that we were bad, and I'm not here to play word semantics with you, but I did bad things, and the thing about the book is it talks about, I love it because people say, oh, don't hurt my feelings because I'll drink, and the big book does give it credit. It says that the alcoholic is sensitive, you know, in the chapter to the wives, it talks about that. But then the next sentence says, and it may take some of us a long time to overcome this serious handicap. It's a handicap. It's not an asset for me, you know. And, you know, or they say, you know, don't hurt. What it's like to me, the best way to describe it, okay, is I was as sensitive as a rhinoceros, okay. When I drank, I would stick a gun in your face and take your money. I would burglarize your home. I'd do whatever I had to do. But then I come into AA and I say, please don't hurt my feelings. Okay, that's a bunch of crap. Okay, if I'm honest about it. Okay, and so I'm talking to this director. The Defiance came back out. I walked away from the program. I went back into the projects, the Weymouth projects this time with the same friends and acquaintances. And it wasn't long before that man took a drink, and then the drink took the drink, and then the drink took me. And I had heard that saying way back in 1972. And I didn't quite understand it. I didn't understand that I was trying to overcome an obsession that I had absolutely no control over, and that I had this allergy in my body, that when I put alcohol in my body, I had no, that alcohol demanded another drink, okay? And that's what set me off and running. And that led up to November 14th. I'm going to jump through real quick here. Led up to November 14th, 1979. I'm sitting up on a bridge called the Bourne Bridge in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, 169 feet up in the air. And, you know, I'm up there 4.5 hours, and it's a big drama, and the state police blocked off the bridge, and the Corps of Engineer and Coast Guard were down below with spotlights on me, and the Good Samaritan Suicide Prevention League was there talking to me on bullhorns, trying to talk me down, and underneath is this campground, and the campers all came out and set up lawn chairs and stuff, and they're yelling at me, jump, you motherfucker, jump, right? Hey, and they're yelling at me, you know, and I'm looking down at these guys going, oh, my God, these guys are crazy. Don't they know if I jump, I'm going to die? And, you know, I'm up there, and I got me on me, and I can't get me off me, and I'm thinking all this bad stuff throughout my life. I'm not thinking about being a Boy Scout and being trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent, right? I remember all that stuff. I remember good stuff that people tried to instill on me. I'm not remembering getting honored by the House of Representatives and getting a plaque for saving this kid's life when I was 9 years old. I'm remembering this stuff like coming home from school and having my dad meet me at the door and having a milk bottle with the top cut off and taking me to my room, and there was a lock on the outside of the door, and he puts me inside the room and he locks it from the outside, and the room is so dark I can't see, and I find the light and turn it on, and my whole window had been sheet metaled and riveted, you know, and he would let me out in the morning to go to school and lock me in at night. I'm remembering those things, you know, and I'm trying to think that there's got to be something, okay? There's got to be something. And I made the decision to get down. I thought I had tried just about everything, and I made the decision there's got to be something out here. and I decided to get down. And this is why I tell this story, to show the cunning, baffling, and powerfulness of this disease, the insidiousness of it. Because when I stood up to get down, I had another thought, and it was an honest thought, and it was a real thought. And that was simply, you know what, Scotty, if you get down, you're going to look like a pussy to all these people that have waited all this time. You got to jump, okay? And so I turned and I jumped, you know. I don't remember hitting the water. They say I died. They say I was dead for almost 13 and a half minutes. The only bone I broke was my sternum bone and chest cavity, and that was from them giving me the precardial thumps, bringing me back to life, you know. Yeah, they don't do that anymore because it can cave your chest in and kill you. So I made it, as my friend Jim Buckley says, to another Homes of the Bewildered, okay, strapped to the bed. I tried the Army, my six-month Army career. They called me down for the count trainer. I was taking antabuse every morning in front of the CO. I was on the Bedinghouse program of alcoholism. I ended up getting a Chapter 5 honorable discharge and decided to come to California, the land of golden opportunity, Hollywood, Beverly Hills. I'm going to come out here and I'm going to get discovered, and, you know, I'm going to be in a rock and roll band, all this stuff, you know, delusions of grandeur. And so I come out, and I ended up out in January 9th, 1981. January 16th, I came out of a blackout in L.A. County Jail. And I was out here a total of 7 days. And before it was all over, I heard a saying real quick in California, and that's that you come on vacation and you leave on probation. The only problem was they weren't letting me go. And before it was all over, between L.A. County, San Bernardino County, and Riverside County, I had 22 years sentencing in the state penitentiary in California. I was, you know, just a young man, and I became an animal. You know, those of you that have been in prison know that prison is nothing but a human kennel that breeds violence, and I let it breed the violence in me, and I became an absolute animal. And, you know, I got tattoos all over my body, and I rode really, really hard. This is when Governor Brown was the governor, Jerry Brown, under the old SP laws. And, you know, I went in there, and all those things that you hear happening in prisons happened to me, and I did to other people. And it was just absolute, I had lost all hope. That's the best way to describe it. I had lost all hope. I made it up to an institution in called Tehachapi, and I was told they had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and was I interested in going? And I walked into the meeting, and I sat down, and I sat in the back with my Bonnaroos on and my bandana, and the first thing I heard was Chapter 5 from the Big Book on how it worked, and I had never heard that before. You know, and then they read Chapter 3, more about alcoholism, and I'm thinking, that's me. Now, remember, I had never heard any. I'd been in AA 10 years, never heard any of that, never heard it. I'm hearing it for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, being in and out of AA for 10 years. And I'm thinking, that's powerful. And then this guy, Eddie Miracle, got up, and he said, you know, if you're new, you've come home. He said, you need never be alone again. You're like the prodigal son who had to venture out there, and now you're home. You know, he started talking about our glasses as being half empty or half full. He started talking how we're all children of God, you know. And see, this is the honesty of it. I was very racial, too, okay? I grew up in Boston, one of the most racial capitals in the country in the 70s. We had forced busing and stuff. And my attitude in the California penitentiaries were, if you weren't white, you weren't right, okay? Because that's how I was raised. I believe that a lot of those hates and prejudices are taught us, and it's been a process for me of not so much learning new things as it's been unlearning a lot of the old things, you know. And this guy is sitting here and telling me the best, you know, he's telling me that there's no room for hypocrites in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Either we're all God's kids or none of us are. You know, and my experiences from that time are simply I have a lot of kids, and those of you that have children or nieces, nephews, or your own, you take them, you throw them up in the air, they have the complete faith, hope, trust, love in the world that I'm going to catch them. I'm not going to drop them on his head. You know, and I had to realize that I had that same faith, hope, trust, and love at one time, as we all did. Each and every one of us sitting here has had that same faith, hope, trust, and love. And then I grew up in the world of gimme, 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 take, 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 first come, first serve, early bird gets the worm. If I don't do it, someone else is going to do it. I learned all these hates and prejudices. So here's a man that's been properly armed with the facts about himself up there talking about a program called Alcoholics Anonymous that could do for me what I was seeing it do for him. You know, and he was speaking these spiritual truths, and I believe that luck and chance was passing me by, and I reached up and I grabbed onto it, you know. All my life people told me what a piece of crap I was and what I couldn't do and what I couldn't become, and all of a sudden I'm sitting in rooms just like this with people just like you, and you're telling me what I can do and what I can become if I'm willing to put forth the effort and work for it. And the bottom line here is I jumped into AA like my life depended on it. I got sober. I got 4 years of college behind me inside. I was a high school dropout. I went back to school, got my GED, got 4 years of college. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I was living the dream of Alcoholics Anonymous inside the walls, you know. I ended up, all the laws changed, and I ended up paroling, and I was told that I didn't owe myself a a weekend in the hotel with my girlfriend. I didn't owe myself this, that, or the other thing. If I wanted to make it, I owed myself a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the very first meeting I walked to is I walked up to the, it was a Friday night on March 21st, I walked up to the Rafters in Newhall, California. And I met people like Tommy. I remember when Tom got sober. I remember when Tom met Lori. Okay, I remember when Lori got sober. And I started living the dream of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started businesses. I had an attorney service in Los Angeles, an ex-con with an attorney service in Los Angeles, okay? I called it TNT, attorney service, okay, because we were dynamite, right? I bought a home in Valencia. I joined that rock and roll band that I always wanted to join, you know? I built a custom home on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, had a house in Valencia, used to fly between LA and Boston 4 or 5 times a month, getting picked up by limousines and chauffeured wherever I wanted, you know, making more money than you could shake a stick at, had 13 cars, homes on coast to coast, money, property, prestige, had sponsored all sorts of people, had commitments and panels in Tehachapi State Prison. Was a circuit speaker, was traveling all over the country sharing with you what you too could become if you were willing to put forth the effort and work for it. I got put what I call on a pedestal of H&I, hospital and institution work, okay? And, what happened to me, my story, the bottom line here is not the story of unhappily ever after. Because if you look at these steps that are up here, the way they're outlining is working through the process, okay, and having had that spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message, okay? Now, the spiritual experience or the spiritual awakening that I was talking about, the common solution, okay, is that spiritual experience through the steps where the message is the message of hope and the promise of the freedom of the bondage of self, okay? And how we do that is intense work with others, trying to help others, okay? And there's different things in the book that it talks about, even dealing with sex, that, when it quiets the urge, when to yield to that would mean heartache, okay? And the intensive work with others I was still doing, but to me, it was that throne of judgment again. You know, and you hear people that get up here and talk, and they talk so eloquently how we sit in rooms and we'll sit, oh, God damn, doesn't she got anything new to share? Is she going to share the same stuff? Oh, she's full of crap. She's cheating on her husband. Oh, no, Bill. Oh, man, can't you come up with anything new? He's going to get drunk. And I'm going into these rooms, and I'm sitting in these meetings, and I'm judging everybody. Character assassination, unconsciously, not overtly. You know, not overtly, but I'm talking, I got double-digit sobriety, and I'm Mr. AA, and I started giving these steps back one at a time. I wasn't carrying this message anymore. I was carrying Scotty's message. Look at me. Look at where I came from. Look at where I am now, okay? Seeking through the prayer and meditation. I wasn't seeking through prayer and meditation anymore. You know, I wasn't continuing to take personal inventory. You know, as far as the character defects, I believe we lose a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous on steps 6 and 7. They're probably two of the least understood steps in the whole program. There's only 2 paragraphs in the book, okay, and we breeze right through them. Okay, shortcoming, character defects, they're the same thing, okay, and really they're not. Bill was very eloquent with words. He had a great command of the English language, and I didn't understand it at the time, but I breezed right through them, and I believe we lose a lot of people on step 6 and 7, because I still had those character defects and those shortcomings, and they're back and forth. And they say in AA that we only become as sick as our secrets, and I started having a lot of secrets, okay, even in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was up here professing a belief in a system and a God and a way out that absolutely brings us back from the gates of insanity and death, and then walking out the door and doing something totally different, okay? And I would use the big book as a weapon. Who are you to judge me? Book says it, our sex conduct, God alone is our judge, right? Who are you to judge me? So I was using it like people use the Bible, sort of, okay, to justify and rationalize my behavior. Because as long as I didn't drink, it's okay, okay? And what it was I was just killing myself, okay? And my spirit was going because I was running the show now. The service recovery and the unity that we talk about, the legacies, were no longer there because it was me, 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 me. All about me. What's your name? Jim. All right. Me, 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 me. Enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me, Jim? See? Because that's what I was doing. Really, that's what I was doing. Okay? It was all about me, and then I'd ask you what's your, but really, I want to know about me. What'd you think about me? Money, property, prestige, okay? Now, make no mistake that the big book, When it talks about us becoming, when I talk about us becoming as sick as our secrets, the book says that we have no defense against the first drink. Next sentence, except in a few rare occasions. That's willpower. Willpower. And I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going one of two ways. You're either going towards a drink or you're going away from a drink. There's no middle-of-the-road solution for people like me, and if you're alcoholic, for people like you, okay? And for a long time, I was going towards a drink. I didn't know I was going towards a drink. If you would have asked me the week before I drank if I was ever going to drink again, I would have told you in all honesty and sincerity, no, I'm never going to drink again, okay? But when it says we have no defense, okay, it means we have no defense. I liken it now to, you know, we just ate dinner at Tony Roma's, and let's just pretend here we are at St. Anne's, the home of the Crusaders, okay? Let's just pretend now, okay, that Genghis Khan and the Mongols are at Tony Roma's, and they're coming here right now, okay? And that's what happened to me. They're coming on me. And what I said is, oh, shit, I got to go get some wood at Home Depot. I got to start building my defenses, right? And I'm trying to build all this stuff when it came on me. I had no defense against the first drink. God was nowhere. As my friend says, it's hard for one God to recognize another God, okay? And the bottom line, and yeah, no, really, because that's what we get like. And the bottom line is that's what I did, and I picked up a drink. Not thinking that it was different, not thinking that I was an alcoholic, not thinking that I could control and manage it. I just didn't want to feel what I was feeling anymore. And because of my ego and my pride and my arrogance, okay, it would not allow me to open up to another human being the exact natures of my wrongs, the character defects, and the things that I was doing playing this game, okay? And I ended up drinking. My sponsor, Eddie Miracle, before he died, he had told me, he said, Scott, you know what? He goes, I'm going to tell you something. He says, you're a sharp person. He goes, but your problem is not that you're sharp. Your problem is that you're double sharp. And I looked at him and I said, what do you mean you're double sharp? I'm double sharp. He said, the problem with people that are double sharp is they usually end up cutting their own throats, okay? And I never forgot that. When I drank, I remembered what he said to me. Because, see, I had never gotten another sponsor, okay? I was listening to myself. And in short order, I lost absolutely everything. Absolutely everything. My wife, my kids, my businesses. I lost absolutely everything. I was sucked up. I was 129 pounds, 100 pounds shorter, less than I am right now. Locked up in a little crap hole in Lancaster, California, doing all those outside issues, drinking every day, could not stop drinking. See, I know what it's like when people come in here and they got 10 or 11 days and they make a decision they don't want to drink anymore, and then they walk out the door and they get drunk anyway. You know, the big book refers to this as this type of thinking, that when it's fully established in the alcoholic, he's probably beyond human aid, and that unless locked up, he may die or go permanently insane. See, because I would come in here and I would make the decision I don't want to drink anymore, and I would walk out and get drunk. Well-meaning, well-intentioned people would come up to me that I had known for years. Are you done now? You got enough arrows in your butt now? Some of the sick ones, because I sponsored people 20 years sober, come up, oh, can I be your sponsor now? Oh, that would tick me off, you know, and but I wouldn't show it. I'd smile and I'd walk out the door and get drunk, you know, and the bottom line here is 10 years ago, because we're in December now, 10 years ago, Christmas night, I took a 25 automatic and I shot myself in the head. And the bullet went in the side and it came out the top. And, you know, that loneliness deep down that nothing could touch. You know, in A Vision for You, when it talks about waking up to the terror, the bewilderment, the frustration, the despair, when it's talking about that, it's not talking while I'm drinking and I'm running and gunning. It's talking about when I'm trying to get sober and I'm coming out of it and I'm realizing the havoc and the hearts that are broken and the things that I have done. When people say, I didn't hurt anybody, just myself, I used to say that too. I tore everybody's heart out. I tore people in Alcoholics Anonymous hearts out. I tore my wife and my kids' hearts out. And, you know, I came out of it 4 days later on full life support systems, and I still didn't stop. I still continued to drink. You know, the state of California stepped in, and they pressed charges on me. They charged me with ex-felon with a gun. That's a true story. And before that ordeal was over, they remanded me into custody, and I was sitting in Chino State Prison one more time, and they ruled it was my fourth strike, and they were giving me 25 to life. And I had another thought, and I had an honest thought then, and that was, I want to be sober now. I'll work the steps now, right? You know, I'll get a sponsor now. Where we get spiritual real quick when we go into those places, and I am no different. And I'm back in there, and I got my head shaved, and I'm playing the game one more time. They say we don't regret the past, and I wish to shut the door on it. I was very racial and very violent, and your jacket carries with you, and I found myself in a jackpot, and I found myself in the hole for 28 days, and I got a hold of a piece of paper and a pencil, and I wrote this thing because I knew how hard it was going to be for someone like me to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, because those chips and those medallions were going to absolutely kill me. And I wrote this thing that when one who has wandered far into selfishness and self-centeredness seek to return to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, he will encounter criticism and distrust. There will be those that whisper he's a newcomer again. I don't think he'll make it this time either. You know, these wicked ones are doing not the work of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or of their higher power, but of their own selfish, self-centered interests. They seek to drive the returning member still farther from hope and from sobriety. You know, let the returning member contemplate the rejoicing in heaven over the return of the one that was lost. Let him in no way be disheartened by the suspicion and scorn of others. He can again walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. See, because that's what I felt. That's what this program was founded off of. It was founded off of love and tolerance, okay? One of the things about Dr. Bob, when he one of his last addresses before he died, he talked about boiling everything down to love and service. He talked about not getting caught up in all the Freudian philosophies of the day that detract us and have little to really do with our actual work, okay? And the actual work is the one alcoholic helping another, okay? Till we're strong enough to stand on our own, and then we get to keep it by giving it back away. Okay, these little things, he talked about the stick-to-itiveness of it, okay, and that when he got down, his constant work with others, okay, brought him back up for the boys on the ward at St. Thomas. And so I started doing some work inside prison, and never thinking that this was all going to work out and I was ever going to have the privilege and the honor to get back up here. Never with the thought that I was going to get my wife and my kids back. You know, there's those hopes that we have, but I knew that I was gone for a long time. And through a letter campaign that my wife had started with a relationship that was so damaged, it was so damaged. She had said to me one time, you know, Scotty, I don't even think God can fix this relationship. And I looked at her and I said, well, it just shows how little faith you have. And I didn't really mean that, but it sounded good, right? Yeah, it did. It made her think, right? And she started a letter campaign, and people all over the country wrote this judge, Chelsea McKay, in the Lancaster Superior Court, letters. And on October 7th, 1997, he pulled me out of state prison, and he stood me in front of him. And he had his bench full of papers, and the gallery was full. And he's looking at the papers, and he's looking at me, and he's looking at the papers, and he's looking at me. And he says, you know, I don't understand this. He said, you seem to have helped a lot of people in your life. He goes, I don't understand how you could do this to yourself. See, he didn't understand the disease of alcoholism, how we can build this wonderful picture to our wives, our family, our friends, and we can tell them, no, this time's different. Please give me one more chance. No, I'm going to do it this time. Please, you don't understand. And then we tear the house down. We drink. And usually if you ask them, they don't know why. I didn't, you know, I mean, if you ask them, if we're honest about it, we don't know why. And for some reason, though, you know, through God's grace, if you ever read the Bible or Daniel in the lion's den or Peter sitting there and the light coming and the chain falling off and the gate opening, that's basically my story, because on that day he struck two of my strikes. He released me the next day. He released me with a 5-year tail. And I got out and I jumped back into Alcoholics Anonymous like my life depended on it, because it did. See, I believe with the surrender comes the release. I believe with the absolute surrender comes the release of the obsession. Okay, and for me, it was a question of doing it again. It was a question of waking up in the morning and praying that God removed everything I thought I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, everything I thought I knew about you people, about life, so that he could open me up for new experiences, so that I could become teachable again. I had to become teachable again. Okay, and through a circumstance of events, through hard work, through the steps, through sponsorship and everything, I reassembled that family. Okay, I had another little boy, little Tommy. He's 8 now. I got 5 kids, you know, and through no great act of me, but they're all doing quite well. My daughter, I just became a grandparent last week. My daughter gave birth to a little baby boy, and so I'm a grandparent. They named him Scott after me, you know, and her husband's in the Air Force. My son, Michael, who a few years ago got caught stealing a couple 6-packs of Pepsi out of Bob's house. He's in, remember that? He's in the Army now. He's in human intelligence down in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And he's doing well. You know, I am overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely overpaid. You know, I said one time to my sponsor, you know, I deserve this, and it was some issue that I was probably a relationship issue with my wife. But he said, Scotty, don't ever think that you deserve anything. He says, because what we came in here for is mercy, not justice. And if you got justice, you would not be here. And he told me this story about the devil having a yard sale. And the devil was having a yard sale, and all the tools of his trade were laid out in the yard, everything from the adultery to the murder to the dishonesty and theft. And over in the corner, in a distinction all by itself, was this little wedge. And this little wedge had a higher price than everything else combined. And the little wedge was called discouragement. And when asked from the devil why this was so high, the devil simply replied, when none of this other stuff works, let me get the wedge of discouragement into a man's consciousness, and it opens the door for everything else. And so I had to watch for those little discouragements, okay? And I had to, and I've never thought of it, I've never felt from that day on several years ago that I deserve anything. I am overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And consequently, you know, it's been, life is good. I mean, I've been all over the world. I took my fifth anniversary over at St. Paul's Cathedral right outside the Vatican. I gave a talk there on my fifth anniversary. I've been on cruises and spoke on sober cruises with some of these guys here from Alaska to the Caribbean. I led a meeting at Congress in the Capitol, and my wife and I got invited by the Speaker of the House down to breakfast in the private dining in Congress in the Capitol. I'm not telling you that stuff to impress you. I'm really not. I'm simply telling you that to impress upon you that I don't care where you come from, okay, that there's hope in this program, okay? I was walking through the Capitol on parole, okay, and through the Capitol with generals and senators and all this other stuff, and they're saying hi to me, hi, sir, and stuff, and they don't even know me. They never asked me if I was on parole. I never volunteered it, right? Okay? You know, and I've done the conventions, but I also do the hospital and institution work. My home group is a central group in Utica, New York. I have a panel at the Rescue Mission once a month. I also do Herkimer County Jail once a month, okay? I go into the food pantry, some of my most memorable meetings, and I share this anytime I get the opportunity, because it just hit me between the eyes at this food pantry. And what it was this white woman, she was like 85 years old, she was taking a 30-year medallion, and she talked about what it was in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and she was talking about growing up in the South and what it was like. And there was this big black woman called Mammy, and everybody would go and sit on Mammy's lap. And she remembered when she was 5 years old sitting on Mammy's lap and rubbing Mammy's arm. And Mammy looked down at her and said, "Child, child, my skin is as dark as the night, but my soul is as white as snow, just like yours." You know, and then fast forward 50 years later, in the grips of this disease, she could not stop. And the book talks about women going to pieces a lot quicker than men. She couldn't stop, wanted to stop. She looked down at her skin, and she had that moment of clarity. And she remembered Mammy when she was 5 years old. And when she looked at her skin, she remembered it all, and she cried out to God as we can in that surrender and that desperation. And she said, my God, my skin is as white as the snow, but my soul is as dark as the night. Help me, Father." And he did, you know, and she was taking a 30-year medallion. Now, God doesn't make too hard of terms on us, okay? He's there. It says each and every one of us is the fundamental idea of God deep down in us. It may be obscured by the calamity, the pomp, the worship of other things, but it's there, and it's only there that he may be found. It says in the final analysis, it was so with us. It talks about stepping from the bridge of reason to the desired shore of faith. It talks about it doesn't matter your race, your creed, your color, that each and every one of us is able to build this relationship with the loving God as long as we're honest and willing enough to try. And that's really my story, as I became honest and willing enough to try. I hope that that's your story. I hope you become honest and willing enough to try. We just came from a great retreat. You know, you had a lot of great information, a lot of people that were imparting this knowledge that they had that just helped fill us up, okay? The spirit you could cut with a knife. Now, I happened to get rushed to the hospital that day again. The last time I was here 2 years ago, I got real sick. I was with Tom at a convention in Erie, Pennsylvania a couple years ago, and I ended up getting rushed to the hospital, had colon surgery and all that other stuff, was in 18 days, almost died a couple times, and I hadn't had a bout until I came out here this last weekend, and I was at State Line, and yeah. And because Tom was going to speak, right? No. You know, the thing is here, guys, you know, you hear a lot of stuff, and you hear a lot of talkers get up here, or speakers, whatever your preference is. I was taught that there are no speakers. We're just talkers, one alcoholic talking to another. You hear a lot of people get up here with their opinions, okay? And that's what you've heard, a lot of my opinions tonight, but I base them off this book right here, okay? It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And my suggestion, if you're new and you raise your hand, is get into the book. Find someone that's properly armed with the facts about themselves that can take you through this process, okay? That's literally going to open up your whole world. See, a lot of us did a lot of the dying we were ever going to do out there, okay? And we come in here, and this is a program for the living. And I mean that, okay? And the miracle is not so much that we're sober. The miracle is that we're alive to even be here right now. You know, St. Francis said to preach the gospel wherever you go, and when necessary, use words, okay? And that's what we do when we get up here. We try to use words, okay? To try to express what AA has done for us, to us, and for us, and can do for you too with this common solution. I can literally talk for hours and hours and hours about the history, about the steps, about what Alcoholics Anonymous is and what Alcoholics Anonymous isn't, okay? And how I did that was becoming a student of Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? By opening myself up to people, okay, so that I could gain some of this knowledge that would better equip me, okay, so that I can help another human being. I'll leave you with this. I was in prison, and I read this book called Man's Search for Meaning. And in the book, it was about a Nazi concentration camp. And all the death and the destruction and everything going around. And this guy, I got one little sentence out of the whole book, and he said that man need not be ashamed of tears, for tears bear witness that man has the greatest of courage, the courage to suffer. Our book says that all men of faith have courage. See, we don't apologize for our God here, okay? How can we, okay? Father Ed Dowling said that if he ever gets to heaven, it's not going to be for any of his great works. It's just going to be simply because he backed away from the gates of hell. And I think that's what a lot of us have done here. Not for our great works, okay? But it's simply that we backed away from the gates of hell. I'll leave you with this, that when you get what you want and you struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, just go to a mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass. The fellow whose verdict that counts most in your life is the one staring back from the glass. He's a fellow to please, never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear up till the end. And you've passed your most dangerous, difficult test if the man in the glass is your friend. Some people may call you a straight-shooting chum and call you a wonderful guy, but the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. You may fool the whole world down the pathway of life and get pats on your back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartaches and tears if you've cheated the man in the glass. I cheated myself for a long time, both in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like my booze watered down, what do I want this program watered down for? This is the real deal, okay? And if you're an alcoholic, we have the common solution. And I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.